I hope you've all remembered to sign your consent forms. You may think you've come to hear a talk, but in fact, this is an experiment being carried out by the psychology department here to test how the world is going to react in 3 or 4 years by the time there's been a doubling of the carbon dioxide level. When people start passing out on the floor, I'll take that as a sign we experiment's over. I'll say a few words about Iraq, but then I want to turn to more background issues, continuing issues that lie beyond what's going on now. Actually, what we get lots of reports from Iraq, but they're very narrow in their character. Almost entirely, they come from within the green zone, the carefully protected zone inside Baghdad, where the U.S. forces are located, the chosen government is, and where most of the journalists stay. And what doesn't come from there is usually controlled by the occupying army in some fashion or other. That's not because journalists are lazy or lack courage. It's just that it's far too dangerous to go out of the protected area. I'll read you an excerpt from a recent letter that's been circulating in major newsrooms by a Wall Street Journal correspondent. Recently published in one of the internal journals. He says, being a correspondent in Baghdad these days is like being under virtual house arrest in the protected green zone. Outside is raging a barbaric guerrilla war. The numbers of dead and injured are so shocking that the Ministry of Health has now stopped disclosing them. Insurgents now attack Americans 87 times a day. This was a couple of weeks ago. If under Saddam, Iraq was a potential threat, under the Americans, it has been transformed to an imminent and active threat, a foreign policy failure that is bound to haunt the United States for decades to come and the world. The genie of terrorism, chaos, and mayhem has been unleashed onto this country, and it can't be put back into a bottle. The cops are being murdered by the dozens every day, over 700 to date, and the insurgents are infiltrating their ranks. The problem is so serious that the U.S. military has allocated $6 million to buy out 30,000 cops they just trained to get rid of them quietly. Many details are there's a lot of instructive material that comes from captured Westerners who've been released. This includes recently a Canadian war correspondent who was released after several weeks in captivity in a Turkmen area. I'll read some of his remarks later if you'd like, but it essentially fill out the details of the story that we're not being told, not because journalists don't want to, but because it's virtually impossible for them to. One veteran British correspondent, Patrick Coburn, who's worked in the area for decades, written books and articles, many articles about it, writes recently that the occupation is one of the most extraordinary failures in history. And it is indeed an extremely surprising failure. The fact of the matter is that the Nazis had far less difficulty in occupied Europe, and they were in the middle of a major war. I should stress that success and failure are not the same thing as right and wrong. Those are totally different dimensions. I'm keeping to the success-failure dimension. Right and wrong, you can figure out for yourselves. This is the dimension that has to do with the consequences that are likely to ensue. The best explanation that I've heard about the entirely unexpected and quite remarkable failure of the occupation It was about a year ago from a high official of one of the leading relief organizations. I can't identify him, but he's had experience all over the world in the worst imaginable places. Came back briefly to the United States after several months in Baghdad trying to get hospitals organized and so on. And he said he had never seen such a combination of arrogance, ignorance, and incompetence. He's referring not to the troops on the ground, but to the civilian leadership in the Pentagon. In Iraq, they have achieved pretty much what they've achieved in the international arena very quickly, namely turned the United States into the most feared and often hated country in the world, which is not a small achievement. Polls in Iraq about early this spring, that's before the terrible fighting in April and before the Abu Ghraib exposures, polls then showed that the population regarded the American forces there by about 10 to 1, regarded them as an occupying, not a liberating force. Support for the occupying army was in single digits. It's reduced considerably since then. Rumsfeld, Cheney, and the rest of them have even succeeded in turning the young cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr, who was previously a marginal figure, they succeeded in making him the second most popular political figure in Iraq, right after the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, and it's all much worse now. After the offensives that are now just getting underway, one hesitates to think what the situation will be like. The effect in the world has been much the same. Most recent poll, international polls show that in Muslim countries, large majorities regard the United States as a direct military threat, and that's high numbers, like over 70% in countries like Indonesia, Turkey, Pakistan, Nigeria. In Europe, considerable majorities in most of the countries regard the United States as a threat to world peace. Holland, Britain, France, others. In some countries, a dislike and the distrust of the United States has doubled or tripled just in the last year. In Latin America, which happens to have the most experience with the United States and its power, among Latin American elites who are the most pro-U.S. element in their countries, about 90% are strongly opposed to Bush and his policies. That reaches 98% in Brazil and almost as high in Mexico. And there are, I should say that this is not entirely new. The scale is new, but not the phenomenon. Back in 1999, under Clinton, that is, Foreign Affairs, the main establishment journal, had an article by a leading American political scientist, Samuel Huntington of Harvard, in which he pointed out that for much of the world, he said, regards the United States as a rogue state and the greatest external threat to their existence. That was 1999. It's escalated very sharply since. Within the foreign policy elite, similar views are now quite widely expressed, actually to a completely unprecedented level. I don't think there's ever been anything like this. So just to take a recent example, the sober and respectable institution, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, publishes a regular journal, not given to hyperbole. In their current issue, there's an article by two well-known leading strategic analysts who discuss, not Iraq, they discuss the what's called the transformation of the American military. That's the Rumsfeld-initiated program to rapidly increase lethal offensive military capacity. which is, of course, leading to the anticipated response among others. And they discuss this, and they say this policy is likely to lead to, in their words, ultimate doom. Those are words you don't usually hear in sober, respectable circles referring to U.S. policy. They actually go on to express the hope that China will lead a coalition of peace-loving countries to counter U.S. Militarism and aggressiveness. We've gotten to a pretty pass when we hear that from the heart of the establishment. Notice that they didn't ask Canada to lead the coalition, and you might wonder why. Well, part of the reason for all of this is, of course, the invasion of Iraq, which was carried out against overwhelming international opposition. Again, it's hard to, actually, it's worth remembering that this is the first time in the entire history of Europe that there has been massive, overwhelming protest against an aggressive, basically colonial war, before it was even launched. I mean, nothing like that has ever happened before. In the case of the Vietnam War, for example, which is not that long ago, it was 6 or 7 years after the war was launched before protest reached a detectable stage, which is the norm. Usually it never happens. Here it was before. That's part of the reason. But a large part of the reason is the thinking that lies behind it. Now recall that the invasion of Iraq was virtually announced in September 2002, at the same time as the release of the of Bush's national security strategy, a new imperial grand strategy, as it was called right away, in a critical article, again, in the main establishment journal, Foreign Affairs, which described it as a threat to the world and to the United States. It has since been subjected to, again, quite unprecedented critique from within the establishment. I'm not talking about critics. The critique is very broad, but it's also extremely narrow in content. Typically, if you read, say, journals like Foreign Affairs and the other sort of mainstream elite foreign policy journals, there's a tremendous amount of criticism, but on very narrow grounds. It's not that the substance is wrong. It's the style and the implementation that are a danger. The critique was captured pretty well by Madeleine Albright, Clinton's Secretary of State, same journal, Foreign Affairs. She was also quite critical of the national security strategy and the implementation of it. But again, she pointed out that every president has had a similar strategy, but the president keeps it in his back pocket to be used if necessary. You don't smash people in the face with it, and you don't implement it in brazen defiance even of your allies, let alone others. Now, that's just stupid. It's another example of arrogance, incompetence, and ignorance. Albright didn't mention it, but she was fully aware, of course, that Clinton had a similar doctrine, her doctrine. The Clinton doctrine was, I'll quote it, that the U.S. is entitled to resort to unilateral use of military power to defend vital interests, including uninhibited access to key markets, energy supplies, and strategic resources. And it's entitled to do that without even the pretexts that Bush and Blair concocted. Now notice that that's actually more expansive, considerably more expansive than the Bush imperial grand strategy, but it was issued quietly, you know, message to Congress, not brazenly. So, you know, others know about it, but they didn't have to regard it as a direct threat to their existence. Of course, they know that American presidents are going to do that if they want to. That's among the prerogatives of power in societies where state power is under very limited popular control or even knowledge for the most part. And Albright, in the same article, pointed out that there are plenty of precedents for it. And that's true. There are precedents in U.S. history and elsewhere, including precedents one might not want to think about exactly. I'm not going to go into this because it would take us too far afield, but it is interesting to see now the beginning of publications by leading American historians who cite the precedents in U.S. history in most revealing and instructive ways. I'd like some examples. I'll come back to it later. It tells us a lot about the intellectual culture and the likely future. Well, despite the precedents, which indeed exist, the national security strategy was recognized right away to be something new, very new. Henry Kissinger described it as a revolutionary new strategy. He generally approved of it, like everyone else, in substance, but also criticized it in style and implementation, said you got to do it more sensibly. And he also added a crucial qualification. He said that the policy, while right, must not be universalized. That is, the right of aggression has to be reserved to the United States alone, sometimes delegated to its clients and allies. So we must reject forcefully the most elementary of moral truisms, namely, we apply the same standards to ourselves, at least, that we apply to others. Harsher ones, if we're serious. And it's to Kissinger's credit that he's honest enough to say this. Usually it's concealed, so we can thank him for telling us what we ought to know. And he's done it elsewhere. I should say there were other voices. This is not totally uniform. So perhaps the most respected of living American historians, Arthur Schlesinger, the day the bombs started falling on Baghdad, published an article in the major press in which he recalled President Roosevelt's words right after Pearl Harbor. Roosevelt called it a date that shall live in infamy, and Schlesinger said that Roosevelt was right. Today it is Americans who live in infamy as we follow the policy of Imperial Japan. It's an accurate description. He also warned that the global wave of sympathy for the United States after September 11th is turning into a global wave of hatred of American arrogance and militarism. And that prediction was borne out, as we have seen in the time that's followed. It was also predicted right away that the invasion would increase the threat of terror, that those predictions came from foreign intelligence agencies, from independent analysts, and we just learned recently the same prediction was made by the highest U.S. intelligence analysts, the National Intelligence Estimate, in January 2003, just a few weeks before the invasion. That's what they predicted, and that's what happened. The following year, year 2003, is the first worst year on record for suicide bombings. Full figures aren't in for the following year. Iraq had its first suicide attacks since the 13th century. Harvard University's main terrorism specialist, Jessica Stern, wrote that the invasion turned Iraq into a terrorist haven. A country which, whatever you thought about it, hadn't been involved in international terrorism, is now a terrorist haven, a center of terrorism. And that's gone on throughout the world. On the anniversary of the invasion, railroad stations in the United States, Grand Central Station in New York and others, were being patrolled by heavily armed police with submachine guns and flak jackets. That was an immediate reaction to the worst terrorist atrocity in Europe just a couple of days earlier, the bombing in Madrid, which killed a couple of hundred people. Shortly after the Madrid bombing, Spain had an election, and the electorate voted out the government that had gone to war over the objection of probably 90% of the population. They had been very praised, very highly praised for having kicked the population in the face and followed orders from Crawford, Texas, that proved their democratic credentials. And however, they were the Spaniards were very much condemned for having voted them out of office. They were condemned for appeasement and giving in to terror and so on. I didn't see anybody point out that the Spanish voters were voting for the position held by, at that time, about 70% of the American population. And it had been there, the U.S. majority opinion, since shortly after the invasion, not for pulling out troops, but that the U.N. ought to take the lead in security issues, reconstruction, transfer of to a new government in Iraq. Now, there is a difference between Spain and the United States. In Spain, people know what public opinion is. In the United States, you know it only if you carry out a research project. Secondly, in Spain, you can vote on it. In the United States, it's inconceivable that that issue would arise in an election, and as you can see, there's no hint of it in the current electoral campaign. Now, those are important matters. They have to do with the very significant deterioration of democratic culture, not just in the United States, but in a good part of the West. The issues that are of prime concern to people are simply excluded from the political arena because people aren't supposed to be there. They're supposed to be obedient and quiet and do something else. And this is a striking example of it, hardly the only one. There's a curious performance that's been going on the last couple of months in Washington and the media, you know, intellectual circles and so on. It was initiated by leaks from the Bush administration, Paul O'Neill, Richard Clark, and others, indicating that they had downgraded the war on terror in favor of an invasion of Iraq. And that was supposed to be very surprising. The only thing that's surprising about those revelations is that anybody's surprised by them. It's completely obvious. I mean, they invaded Iraq, okay? That settles the question. They invaded Iraq knowing that it was very likely to increase the threat of terror as it did. What more is there to discuss? I mean, that tells you what their priorities are. We don't need any leaks. Furthermore, those priorities are entirely rational. It's perfectly understandable. It's not hard to figure out why. It's been known for years, I mean, certainly since 1993, it's been known that there's a risk of serious terrorist acts in the United States that may kill thousands of Americans, maybe more. After all, in 1993, there was an attempt to blow up the World Trade Center, which came very close to succeeding, and with much more ambitious plans that were just barely aborted. These were carried out by people whose origins were in the jihadis that were organized, trained, armed by the CIA and its associates, and had quite openly turned against the United States by the early 90s. And since then, anyone who reads headlines, at least, was aware that, yes, there's a serious terrorist threat. The technical literature was full of discussions of it, some books and articles that were almost cookbooks for how to carry out serious terrorist acts. Nobody could predict that something was going to happen on September 11th, or it would be exactly this, but that some major terrorist act was likely to happen was not a surprise, and that it might have very serious consequences, just as it's anticipated today, is just not important. It doesn't rank very high in importance as compared with establishing the first stable military bases in what they hope will be a dependent client state in the right at the heart of the world's major energy resources, a state which itself has the second largest oil resources in the world that are known, and which has been considered ever since the 1940s as what the State Department called a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the greatest material prizes in world history. I mean, that's since the 1940s. And ever since then, a prime element of U.S. foreign policy has been to maintain control over it. How could it be otherwise? You know, notice that what's important is control, not access. I mean, if the U.S. was running on solar energy, the policy wouldn't change. The point is, it's a stupendous source of strategic power. It gives what Zbigniew Brzezinski recently called a critical leverage over Europe and European and Asian economies. And those have been the primary rivals and threats to the United States since the Second World War. They have to be kept under control. Those are the major industrial societies and centers, even more so now. And it's one of the ways to keep them under control is by keeping your finger on the, you know, the flow of energy to them. That's what much of the jockeying around Central Asia is about, and where the pipelines will go and so on. And controlling roughly two-thirds of the world energy resources, you know, that's no small question. Quite apart from the stupendous source of strategic power and the critical leverage it gives of others over others, it's perfectly true that it's an enormous material prize. One history of the oil industry describes describes it as a source of profits beyond the dreams of avarice. And they're supposed to go to U.S. companies, maybe some to British companies, as long as they play their role, but not to others. All of those are perfectly good reasons for establishing a major military presence right at the heart of the energy-producing region. Iraq happens to be particularly significant in this respect. For one thing, it's the only known area of the world where there are enormous energy resources that are still untapped, in fact, largely unexplored, and furthermore, very easily accessible. You don't have to dig through permafrost or figure out how to deal with the Alberta tar sands or anything like that, and you just stick your finger in the ground. I mean, the oil's practically bubbling out. And there's nothing remotely like it. And furthermore, it's it was understood that others are getting ahead of the U.S. and its British client in this. The French and the Russians had the inside track on dealing with it. They were beginning to develop and open up unexplored oil fields, and that won't do. That's finished with the invasion. U.S. and a few British companies will get the profits beyond the dreams of avarice, and the U.S. will have critical leverage thanks to its control of this stupendous source of strategic power. If Iraq can be kept under control, which has proven to be a surprisingly difficult task. Well, there's plenty of other evidence that terror is not considered a serious threat as compared with, or a serious issue as compared with other priorities. All of this ought to be front page headlines every day, in my opinion. There's nothing secret or obscure or difficult to detect about any of this. Last December, Congress passed almost unanimously what was called a Syria Accountability Act that threatened Syria with all sorts of penalties and so on and so forth unless it followed U.S. orders. In fact, those threats were then implemented in policies that Bush declared a couple of months later. Well, Syria has been a major asset in the war on the so-called war on terror. It's been providing intelligence, giving information, you know, leading to helping to detect and identify Islamic radicals who it detests and is frightened of. But that has to be cut off. It's not important. Technically, Syria is on the official list of states that sponsor terrorism, but it hasn't been accused by the CIA or anyone of sponsoring terrorism for, about 15 years. And how seriously that's taken, we can tell very easily. Clinton offered Syria, made an offer to Syria that he would remove it from the list of states sponsoring terrorism if Syria agreed to U.S. plans as to how to settle the Israel-Arab conflict. Well, you know, Syria wanted its territory back, so they didn't accept it, so they stay on the list of states sponsoring terror. That tells you something about the priorities. Discipline and obedience are far more significant than reducing terrorist threats. If Syria had been removed from the list, that would have been the first time anyone had been removed since 1982. In 1982, the Reagan administration, which, remember, is essentially the current administration or its immediate mentors, basically the same, the Reagan administration in 1982 removed the country from the list of states sponsoring terrorism, namely Iraq. They did that so that they could supply their friend Saddam Hussein with needed aid, including quite substantial dual-use technology that could be used for developing missiles and nuclear weapons and biological agents and so on. And they continued to do that. We caught a little piece of the television news coming in and noticed a lot of hullabaloo. They found a mass grave up in northern Iraq, which they think is probably Kurds, massacred in 1988. And that shows what an awful guy Saddam Hussein was. But as usual, when these comments are made, nobody pointed out that when he goes to trial for that, there ought to be some people standing next to him, like Ronald Reagan, George Bush, the leaders of the British government, in fact, most of the New Labour, you know, on and on. Yeah, they knew about it. They just didn't do anything about it because they didn't care. And they continued to supply him. It had nothing to do with the Iran war, continued after the Iraq-Iran war was over. And in fact, they were kind enough to tell us why they were doing it. The George Bush administration explained to Congress that we have to keep supplying our friend Saddam out of our responsibility to support U.S. exporters, and because it increases stability in the region. Stability means following our orders. It's a term used by political scientists. And also they added the usual boilerplate about it, how it improves human rights. I mean, that went right up to the day of the invasion of Kuwait. In fact, it actually continued afterwards when the U.S. and Britain supported his crushing of the Shiite rebellion. But Iraq was indeed removed from the list of terror states in 1982 for those reasons. Now deep in the memory hole, but not controversial. There happened to be, when they were removed, there was a gap. Somebody had to be put in. So Cuba was added to the list of states sponsoring terrorism, presumably in recognition of the fact that the terrorist war that the United States had been carrying out against Cuba since Kennedy had escalated in the late 70s to a real peak, you know, with major atrocities, shooting down airplanes, killing 75 people, and you know, all sorts of other things. The terrorists responsible for that are happily living in places like Florida. And remember that a core part of the Bush doctrine is that states that sponsor, that harbor terrorists, are the same as terrorist states and must be treated accordingly. In any event, and still goes on, Cuba was added to the list of terrorist states to replace Saddam, who was removed, and Syria was kept on because they refused to accept Clinton's demands about how to deal with their problems with Israel. Well, there's plenty of other evidence right in front of our eyes that matters like, say, discipline, you know, following orders, are ranked far higher than terrorism as priorities. So a couple of months ago, the Treasury Department gave Congress its regular information about one of its offices. It's the Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC. That's an office which is devoted to monitoring suspicious transfers of funds internationally. Okay, that's a core part of the so-called war on terror. You know, you want to know where funds are moving around. And indeed, they do have officials, they reported to Congress, who are monitoring fund transfers that are suspected of being related to Al-Qaeda or Saddam Hussein. Four employees. They have almost six times that many devoted to inspecting possible evasions of the U.S. embargo against Cuba. Well, I'll tell you something about priorities. An illegal embargo, you know, declared illegal by every imaginable body. But it doesn't make any difference, and this is not Bush. This goes way back. They also gave figures on the monitoring of suspicious fund transfers since 1990, from 1990 through 2003, and said that there had been 93 investigations of terrorist-related or Iraq-related fund transfers with $9,000 in fines, and 11,000 investigations with $8 million in fines for suspicion of evading the U.S. Embargo against Cuba. Well, that tells you something about priorities. And we know the reasons for that. U.S. very free country, tons of documents available. And we know very well from the Kennedy-Johnson years that the main problem of posed by Cuba, as the State Department and the CIA described it, was Cuba's successful defiance of U.S. policies going back to the Monroe Doctrine, 1820s, namely the policy that the U.S. will dominate the hemisphere. And you don't tolerate defiance of that. So 40 years of terrorist war, illegal and economic embargo, massive inspection of maybe attempts by others to evade it. All of that is far more important than inspecting funds that might be involved in, say, financing Al-Qaeda. And the numbers illustrate it. So the fact that we can go on and on with this, but the fact that the Bush administration downgraded the threat of terror in favor of much higher priorities is nothing new. And the threat of successful defiance is a very serious one. Those of you who don't understand it can ask your favorite mafia don and ask how he reacts if some local storekeeper doesn't pay his protection money on time. You don't just take the money. You know, you make an example of him, because successful defiance is extremely dangerous in a system of order that's run rather like the mafia. And in fact, it's not a bad description of world order, I'm sorry to say. Well, turning to terror, there's a very broad consensus among intelligence agencies, including Israeli intelligence in this case, independent experts and so on, there's a very broad consensus on how to deal with it, how to reduce it, how to enhance it. Incidentally, I should mention that I'm using the term terror here in a kind of technical sense, the sense in which it's universally used in Western discourse, meaning the terror that they carry out against us, and not the terror that we carry out against them. That's not terror that you don't discuss. So I apologize for the usage, but I'll keep to that conventional usage. And there is a consensus on how to react to it, if you want to increase it or if you want to deal with it somehow. Actually, the Iraq invasion is a perfectly good example of what to do if you want to escalate it or you don't care about it. As I mentioned, it was undertaken with the expectation, soon verified, that it would increase the threat of terror. And that's pretty normal. Violence quite typically elicits violence in response. Not a big surprise. You know, everyone understands it, including intelligence agencies. Actually, take, say, Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda and bin Laden were virtually unknown. In fact, Al-Qaeda is not even mentioned in U.S. intelligence records, and bin Laden was considered some minor financier until 1998. What put them on the map was Clinton's bombing of Afghanistan and the Sudan. That led to a very rapid increase in recruitment and financing for Al-Qaeda, and it made bin Laden a kind of a symbol for much of the Muslim world. The bombing of Afghanistan, in particular, established close relations between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, which had previously been pretty cool or even hostile. The bombing of the Sudan is completely ignored in the West, which is kind of interesting. I mean, if, say, Al-Qaeda blew up half the pharmaceutical supplies in Canada, somebody would probably notice it, you know. And in fact, if Canada was a poor country under embargo, so it couldn't get drugs, so maybe tens of thousands of people died, people might notice it even more. And that's what happened in the Sudan. And to us, it doesn't make any difference because we're doing it to poor Africans, so who cares? But it does matter to other people. Not everyone reacts the same way the privileged and the powerful do. And in fact, we learn a lot about ourselves from the null reaction to these events in the West. And in fact, hysterical denial and tantrums, if they're ever brought up, tells us a lot about ourselves, also useful to know. Well, the next major contribution to the growth and expansion of Al-Qaeda was the bombing of Afghanistan. That led, again, to a sharp increase in recruitment and financing, and made bin Laden even more of a major figure. The bombing was undertaken without any real pretext, no credible pretext at least. In fact, 8 months after the bombing, the head of the FBI testified to the Senate that after the most intensive intelligence inquiry in history, they still didn't know who was responsible for 9/11. They said they believed that the plot might have been hatched in Afghanistan, but was probably implemented and financed in the United Arab Emirates and in Europe. That's 8 months after the bombing. Assume that everybody's guess is correct, but they didn't know that and still don't know it. The bombing was also undertaken over the strong and vocal objections of many of the most important Afghan opponents of the Taliban, including U.S. favorites, barely reported in the West. And it did lead in a sharp increase in recruitment and enthusiasm for what's called the cosmic struggle between good and evil. That's the rhetoric shared by bin Laden and Bush. Actually, in the last couple of minutes, I've been mostly paraphrasing the best book on Al-Qaeda, Jason Burke, British journalist analyst. And he runs through the record. You can find it elsewhere. And he points out correctly that every use of force is another small victory for bin Laden. And that general conclusion is very widely shared among intelligence agencies and specialists. And we see it right in front of us all the time. The case of Muqtada al-Sadr, which I mentioned, is a perfectly clear example. Fallujah. There's another attack in the works. In fact, it's been under bombardment for the last month. But last April, there was a major marine assault on Fallujah, which killed nobody knows how many people. We never count our victims, but you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of people, which practically set off a conflagration that could have blown the whole country up. That attack was it's an example of how violence elicits violence, but the story goes back further. The attack on Fallujah was a reaction to the brutal murder of four U.S. military contractors a couple of days earlier, another case of violence eliciting violence. But that's not the beginning of the story either. Those four military contractors were killed by a previously unknown group called Brigade of Martyrs of Sheikh Yassin. They were avenging the murder of a quadriplegic Muslim cleric a couple of days earlier right outside a mosque in Gaza by what's called in the West an Israeli attack. But it's not an Israeli attack. It's a U.S.-Israeli attack. It's an attack by U.S. airplanes, U.S. helicopters piloted by Israeli pilots. The U.S. Israel doesn't make helicopters. The U.S. sends them helicopters, knowing perfectly well that they are not for any defensive purpose. They are for the purpose of actions like carrying out assassinations, like the assassination of Sheikh Yassin and half a dozen or so bystanders who just happened to be there. In the previous 6 months, the Israeli press reports, there had been 50 such murders, that's what they are, murders of suspects, mostly by U.S.-supplied equipment supplied for that purpose, along with 80 or 90 bystanders, all murders. Numbers are much higher if you go back further. Well, none of this enters the annals of state terrorism, but that's because of agency. Since we're doing it, or our clients are doing it, it's not terrorism, but others, again, don't necessarily look at it that way. In this particular case, the assassination of Sheikh Yassin led directly to the killing of the four military contractors, which led in return to the attack on Fallujah, which practically blew up the country. Well, those examples are unfortunately quite typical. It's true that violence tends to elicit greater violence. As to reducing terror or the threat of terror, there's also a broad consensus on that. It's a two-pronged affair. The terrorists themselves are carrying out criminal acts, undoubtedly. They should be dealt with the way people are dealt with when they carry out criminal acts. That's police work, police investigation, police work, apprehension, international if required, fair trials. That's the way you deal with criminal acts, if you care about criminal acts. The terrorists themselves, they regard themselves as a vanguard. They're trying to mobilize a population which may dislike them, in fact, may hate them, you know, may fear them, but does recognize that there's something just about their cause. And therefore, it's a population that can be mobilized. And we can help the terrorist vanguard mobilize that reservoir of support by doing what they want, namely carrying out violent acts, which will help them mobilize the sympathy and support and recruitment and financing by seeming to demonstrate that their message is correct. That's what we're like. That's one way, that's the way to escalate it if that's our interest. Or we can reduce the terrorist threat by the obvious means. Paying attention to the grievances of this mass of people who they are trying to mobilize. And if you look, those grievances are often quite legitimate and ought to be dealt with totally independently of any connection with terror. But if you happen to be interested in reducing terror, that's the way to reduce the threat. And again, there's an overwhelming consensus on this from intelligence agencies, independent experts, and so on. Even by the recent 9/11 Commission, if you read its report carefully, you'll notice that they point out, kind of quietly, that bin Laden's calls find an audience because of anger over U.S. policies ranging from Iraq to Palestine to America's support for their repressive regimes. Yeah, that's correct. That's how it finds an audience. And the 9/11 report isn't telling us anything new. In fact, they're just repeating virtually what the National Security Council, highest planning body, told President Eisenhower in 1958. This was then secret. It's been declassified for years. Eisenhower raised the question why there is what he called a campaign of hatred against us in the Arab world. And the answer had, in fact, been supplied by a National Security Council analysis right then, and said there's anger in the Arab world because of they perceive us as supporting brutal and repressive regimes, blocking democracy and development, and doing it because of our interest in controlling their energy supplies. And they said, yeah, perception is correct, and we ought to keep doing it because that's important. In later years, plenty of other things were added, like Israel-Palestine, or like the Iraq sanctions, which are killing hundreds of thousands of people, and were a huge issue in the Arab world and other policies. So yes, the 9/11 Commission is correct. There is an audience, and Bin Laden's calls find receptive ears, even among people who may hate and fear him, because in fact they know they're as main targets as they are. And we can help that by refusing to pay attention to the grievances. These threats are being consciously escalated. I'll give a couple of examples. There are many more. Furthermore, there are much more dramatic and ominous examples of how violence elicits the threat and, unfortunately, likelihood of far greater violence, which aren't as much discussed. Let's go back to the transformation of the American military. That's a major threat, in this case, a threat to survival. The two military analysts that I was quoting in the Journal of the American Academy were not exaggerating when they said it might lead to ultimate doom. And we can see it happening before our eyes. Early this year, the Russians had their first major military exercise in about 20 years. And they displayed newly developed offensive weapons, nuclear-tipped missiles, more sophisticated weaponry aimed at the United States, and pointed out exactly why. They said this is a response to increase in U.S. Aggressiveness and militarism, which they regard correctly as a threat. So they're going to react to it. They're going to react to it in the only way they can, by increasing their own offensive military capacity. In fact, according to U.S. analysts, they may have tripled military expenditures since the Bush administration came in response to the transformation. They've officially adopted Bush's first strike policy. They're placing the weapons on automated response, launch on warning, which means computer-controlled response. We know our own systems have in hundreds of errors every year. Our systems allow U.S. systems 3 minutes for human intervention if a computer analysis warns that a missile attack is coming, which happens all the time, some false alarm. 3 minutes warning, 3 minutes time to intervene and stop it. And there have been plenty of such cases, literally hundreds every year. The Russian systems are far less sophisticated. They're also deteriorating with the collapse of the Soviet economy. It's virtually asking for an accidental nuclear war, which will be the end. Once that happens, the effect escalates and it's basically over. Furthermore, the U.S. is forcing the Russians to move missiles all over the country to transfer them from one place to another over this huge territory. Their missile systems deteriorate quickly. They're nowhere near as sophisticated. They don't have as many of them. And they're traveling in trains, unguarded trains, right across central Russia. It's not going to take much for Chechen rebels to pick them up sometime. And then you get the ultimate catastrophe. And they're doing that, and U.S. strategic analysts warn about this publicly in reaction to the increasing threat. Partly this is the increasing threat of new nuclear weapons programs, which they see, we call them low yield, but they describe them the way American analysts describe them, as aimed at Russian command bunkers hidden deep in mountains, just like U.S. ones are, which would destroy their deterrent capacity, so therefore they have to increase it. They're also reacting to the militarization of space. One component of the national security strategy, which is much more dangerous than those that have been discussed, has not been much discussed. And that's right after the national security strategy was announced in September 2002, the Air Force Space Command came out with its plans for the coming years, and they include a program of implementing the national security strategy by moving from, this is their words, from control of space for military purposes to ownership of space for military purposes. That's consistent with the national security strategy. No potential threat ever can be tolerated. It has to be destroyed right away. So we have to own space for military purposes. Actually, the UN Disarmament Commission has been deadlocked for years. This goes back to the Clinton years. because of U.S. refusal to go along with the rest of the world, led in this case by China, those analysts know what they're talking about, to live up to the Outer Space Treaty, which limits the use of space to peaceful purposes. The U.S. refuses because Clinton wanted control of space for military purposes. We've now moved up to ownership, which means instant engagement anywhere with highly lethal weapons, attacking with virtually no notice over anywhere in the world, which will be under very tight surveillance. So you can tell from U.S. command bunkers if a car is crossing the street in, you know, Istanbul or whatever. That essentially puts the world under threat of, any part of it under threat of instant destruction. And the foreign intelligence agencies can read these studies just as well as you can, or I can, right on the internet. You know, doesn't take any great genius to find them. And they react. The Russians are reacting. The Chinese are now reacting. China is the one country with nuclear weapons that has not yet developed an offensive nuclear capacity. It's a very tiny one, about 20 vintage 1970s missiles. They've just announced that they're tripling their missile force, making it more advanced and lethal, probably MIRV their missiles. They're planning a high-tech offensive a nuclear capacity within the next couple of years. And they also say just what the Russians do. This is a reaction to U.S. aggressiveness and militarism. One of the threats that concerns them greatly is what's called here missile defense. Defense sounds polite, you know, but on both sides, strategic analysts agree that missile defense is a first strike weapon. That's the way it's understood. In fact, China and U.S. analysts describe it in the same words. They say it's a sword, not just a shield. It provides space for aggressive military action on the assumption you may be able to resist retaliation. That's the way it's understood, and of course they respond to it exactly as everyone predicts, every analyst predicts. In fact, how they're going to react is well known from the way the U.S. reacted. Documents have recently been declassified about a year ago about how the U.S. reacted when Russia put up a very small missile defense system around Moscow, you know, tiny missile defense system. Well, you know, U.S. reacted, as you'd guess, by rapidly increasing its offensive nuclear capacity, not only to destroy that system and overwhelm it, but to wipe out all the radar stations anywhere and so on. Chinese going to react any differently to what they regard as a major threat, which Canada may participate in helping bring disaster closer, if that's what you want. These things are going on right now. I mean, the missile first stages of the so-called missile defense system are supposed to be put into place right about now. If China increases its capacity, India will too. Pakistan will react to that. We're off and running. There's also a huge threat from West Asia, which I can talk about, but it's getting late, and I won't. Just back to Iraq for a moment. As you know, I don't have to go through this, all the pretexts for the invasion have collapsed, so nobody much talks about them anymore except Fox News and Wall Street Journal editorials. As they collapsed, new pretexts were put in their place. And the most recent one, which is now considered the standard, the gold-plated standard, is what the liberal press calls Bush's messianic vision to bring democracy to Iraq and the Middle East and, you know, maybe Mars. Maybe that's what the Mars mission is for. That's the messianic vision. That was announced with great fanfare about a year ago, and the reaction has been very instructive. It tells us a lot about ourselves. The reaction was virtually 100% acceptance in the West among commentators that this was the goal. What's the evidence for it? Well, you know, leave that as a research project for you. You'll find that the sole evidence for it is that our leader declared it. Try to find some other particle of evidence. Anyway, that became the reason. There are plenty of critics. The critics say it's a noble, inspiring vision, but it's beyond our reach. We don't have the means for it. Iraqi culture is too backward to be able to make this dramatic advance, and we ought to be more realistic, and that's the critics. Actually, there's one sector of opinion that disagrees, namely Iraqis. At the same time that the president announced his messianic vision in Washington, the Washington Post did happen to release a poll of people in Baghdad, quietly in the back pages, in which they were asked why they thought the U.S. invaded Iraq. And there were some who agreed with approximately 100% of Western intellectual opinion, namely 1%. 1% said the goal was to bring democracy. Most of the rest said the obvious. Take our resources, use their control of Iraq to organize the region in their interests, and so on. Actually, their reaction was a little more sophisticated. If you look at the whole poll, 1% said the goal was to bring democracy. 50% said the U.S. wants democracy in Iraq, but they explained that that's not a contradiction. The U.S. wants democracy, but will not allow Iraqis to make their own choices. And that's correct. That's the way democracy is imposed in the world. You guys can have democracy as long as you do what we tell you. You know? And they don't need instructions in U.S. history to learn about that. Actually, they know it from their own history. And that's the way Britain ran Iraq. You know, they had parliaments and constitutions and all sorts of nice things. And they were allowed to play their games, just like countries in Central America and the Caribbean are, as long as they do the right things. And in fact, there's domestic analogs too. But so the U.S. wants democracy, but only as long as it can run it. They notice that Iraqis aspire to the same messianic vision that's lauded here, and Iraqis agree with about 100% of Western opinion that there is a cultural problem in achieving it, but they see the problem here, not there. This is a Western problem. The West, U.S. in particular, just isn't. Western culture will not permit such a dramatic change, a democratic, independent, sovereign regime in Iraq. And they got plenty of evidence for that, unfortunately. Well, if Iraqis are right and the primary problem is here, not there, then that's actually a hopeful sign. Because here, we can do something about it. We happen to be very free and very privileged, which means plenty of opportunities. We don't have to wait for China to lead a coalition of peace-loving states to stop the violent and aggressive Western powers. The U.S. allies have a big role to play, major problems right in the United States. That's going to require abandonment of the primary war aims in Iraq, which Iraqis understand, even if we prefer to keep it silent. And it'll require a reanalysis and indeed a sharp change in global policies that are very deeply rooted in institutions and have a long historical record. If that's the correct conception, and my own opinion is that it basically is, it is a hopeful sign, but it means we have choices, and those are fateful choices, not just for Iraqis, but far beyond. And at this stage in human civilization, choices reach as far as literal survival.